Well, we are kicking off our week-long look at the truth behind the 9/11 terror attacks. Everything, of course, we've been told about that day was an orchestrated lie. Every day this week, we're going to have an in-depth interview here on the show on a different part of the 9/11 cover-up. And today, we're kicking it off with Ted Walter. He's the executive director of International Center for 9/11 Justice, and he just led a big symposium over the weekend with his presentation called The 9/11 Hijacking Myth Exposed, and Ted joins me now. Ted, great to have you here.
Great to be here, Clayton. Always good to see you.
And great to see you, and great for all of the work that you've been able to do to put together this big symposium with all of these different speakers to shed the truth, the light on the truth about all of this. So we're starting with the hijacking. But before we get to the hijacking specifically, because you said in your presentation that that is where everything flows from the hijacking part of the story, right? So, and then all of the other pieces come from that. We'll get to that in a second. But first, for someone who's totally believes the narrative of 9/11, who's never been exposed to all of the pieces of truth that you've exposed over the years, can you sort of just give us an umbrella understanding of what are some of the main big lies told on that day?
Absolutely. So I like to boil down the events of the day of 9/11 to basically four key events or four claims that are in the official story. The first is that these four planes were hijacked by 19 young Muslims. The second is that those hijackers somehow managed to fly the planes, navigate them, and fly them all the way to their targets, or at least in three out of the four cases. So you have the flying of the planes. The third is that the U.S. air defense system completely failed to stop these planes from reaching their targets, failed to intercept the planes after they were hijacked. And the fourth claim is then that three skyscrapers in Manhattan collapsed because two planes hit two of those skyscrapers. So those are like the four main events that we're talking about. And I would say over the last 20 years, a lot of focus has been put on, you know, why did the air defenses fail? You know, what was going on with FAA and what was going on with NORAD? And certainly a lot of focus has been put on the question of why did these buildings collapse? And, you know, both in the mainstream and in the, you know, sort of the alternative community of people questioning this story. Particularly the collapse of the buildings. And in my view, it's beyond any doubt established that the Twin Towers and Building 7, the third building that came down on 9/11, were brought down by controlled demolition. Most likely explosives or nanothermite-based explosives that tore the structure apart and totally pulverized all the concrete. And there's just no way that the top of each building could crush the 90 stories of structure below it, even if it started to fall just a little bit. And certainly the heat from the fires was not enough to weaken the steel. And the Building 7 just dropped straight into its footprint. So that's really well established. And even people that are not involved in questioning these issues have probably heard that idea floating around. The two events that I described first, the hijacking of the planes and the flying of the planes, and our argument, which is that there's no way that the alleged hijackers could have actually successfully hijacked the planes and then flown them to their targets. It's less talked about. It's just kind of assumed that that just happened, right? So as an organization, the International Center for 9/11 Justice has decided to put a lot of focus on those first three steps of the story because we feel like the demolition of the buildings is already really well established. And so for this symposium, we were basically presenting research that we've done over the past year, and my focus was on how plausible is the story of these hijackings and do we have any real evidence supporting them? Because when you start to dig into it, all the evidence for the hijacking story entirely come from the phone calls that were made or that were purportedly made from the four aircraft by several of the passengers and flight attendants. And so I can dive into that.
Yeah, let's get to the phone calls in a second. You say that everything starts with the hijacking piece of the story. And you're absolutely right. We've covered extensively here on the show about the buildings. I encourage our viewers to go and see those interviews about the buildings, the controlled demolition of that. That has been a huge part of the story. Most people have been focusing on that. But you're right. I think the hijacking piece of it is arguably more important because that is the theatrics that were used that day to get us all scared, right? That's a changed air travel forever, and we have to take off our shoes. We go through massive screening processes now as a result of all of this, right? The total control and scanning of our faces using biometric data, all of these things. stem from the idea that these planes were hijacked. So let's get there first. You believe that, first of all, these planes were not hijacked. They were controlled. So talk about that, and then I want to play some of the audio clips. You can toss to them, play them however you want, because and tell us what we're hearing.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, there's the plausibility question. Is it plausible that hijackers could really hijack all these planes? And when you look through history, there's only a handful of cases where hijackers have actually tried to remove pilots from the aircraft. And in all these from the controls of the aircraft, and in all of these cases, they're unsuccessful, and it's a really chaotic situation. You know, the fights ensue, passengers and flight attendants get involved. Sometimes the pilots do manage to contact air traffic control, and it's a messy, chaotic, scary situation that usually results in the hijackers not actually getting control of the planes. And on top of that, we know that these hijackers, these alleged hijackers, the so-called muscle hijackers, were all quite small. They're all under the height of 5'7" or 5'8". They all weigh, you know, under 135 pounds or so. And yet, and then we have these pilots on the plane who are all, 6 out of 8 of the pilots are military trained. They all flew in the Air Force and the Marines, et cetera. And then you've got a lot of people on the plane who are also really strong or well trained, who, what happens in these types of situations is that the passengers tend to get involved in stopping the hijacking from happening. So none of that happened. None of that actually happened in these four alleged hijacking incidents. It was almost a seamless event. The situation on these planes was suddenly they were just hijacked. There was no indications externally that the plane was hijacked. The one plane where there was some purported indication of a hijacking was Flight 93, where at 9:28 a.m. In the morning, there were two radio transmissions that came from the cockpit that purported to convey the sounds of a struggle going on in the cockpit. And in both of those transmissions, the pilot said, "Mayday, mayday." And so I offered those for you to play for your audience.
Yeah, let's listen to them right now.
We'll just put them in back to direct St. Louis, and they can put in whatever they want, just so we can get them all back.
Marine.
Please, Bob. That's American 1060.
Yeah, what are we hearing here, though?
Yeah, so first of all, it's very odd that in both of these transmissions, the pilot says, "Mayday, mayday," and doesn't give any more specific information like there's a hijacking or somebody's trying to pull me out of the cockpit or anything. It just says, "Mayday, mayday," right? And if you really listen closely to the second one, and maybe you want to play that one again to get a really close listen, the exact you hear the exact same set of words and sounds in the same rhythm repeat twice. It just like mayday.
Sounds like a loop.
It sounds like a loop. Mayday. Get out of here. Now I don't think it's like verbatim the exact same sound waves, but it's basically a loop.
Let's listen to that one again. Yeah, let's listen to that one again.
That's American 1060.
Yeah. It does, and when you hear it for the first time, it does sound fabricated, but of course, you know, our brains could be playing any sort of tricks on us. But so these recordings, you maintain, are fabricated, and then all of the sort of narrative flows from these recordings, right?
Right. So I wouldn't hang my hat right now and say 100% these are fabricated, although I strongly suspect it. But the even more important thing about these transmissions is that the official story has now committed itself to there being about a minute long or more violent struggle in or near the cockpit of the airplane, like very loud, pilots screaming for their lives, trying to get the hijackers away, etc. And so everybody on Flight 93, which was a Boeing 757-200, you know, it's a jet, but it's not a terribly large plane. And a lot of the people who ended up making phone calls were sitting in first class or sitting near the front of the cabin of coach class, like would have heard or, you know, what was going on. Like there's just no way that would have just stayed contained in the cockpit, right? And so about a minute and a half later, you start getting phone calls supposedly coming from the flight where passengers are reporting what's going on. And lo and behold, and this is for all four planes, not just Flight 93, but Flight 93 is the most obvious because we have these radio transmissions. There's nobody reports the actual cockpit entry, how the hijackers got into the cockpit. Nobody reports how the hijackers defeated the pilots physically. Nobody reports where the pilots are now, what happened to them. There's only two very vague references to what happened to the pilots across the four flights of all the calls. And we're talking about 28 phone calls made by about 19 passengers and flight attendants across the four flights, most of them on flight 93, 12 of them on flight 93. So that gives us the biggest window into this sort of false story. And as you go on, these phone calls are made over the next sort of 20 to 30 minutes, and none of them are consistent. And the biggest one that stands out is the biggest few that stand out are passengers reporting the cockpit invasion happening at that time when they're on the phone. So they're like, so it would be like 15 minutes later, and you have a passenger, Jeremy Glick or Todd Beamer, reporting to the person that they're talking to, yeah, they're getting ready to hijack the plane right now. Okay, yeah, they're going into the cockpit right now, and they're taking the pilots out or whatever. So Todd Beamer, the famous passenger, because he's reported to have said, "Let's roll," when the passengers on Flight 93 supposedly try to take back the plane, he's the one who said, you know, like, "Oh, they're entering the cockpit now." And the person who reported that was very specific that she was on the phone with him for 7 minutes before he reported that. So you've got this story that's coming from the calls that just doesn't add up with the idea that the flight was actually taken over at 9:28 and started to change its course. You've also got, I could go on and on, but you've got totally inconsistent reports, contradictory reports of the violence that's taking place on the planes. So one person describes a passenger being stabbed and killed, and he's sitting next to all these other people, none of whom talk about a passenger being stabbed and killed. They're talking about completely different things. So all of these calls, and I think people have rightly been skeptical of the calls for years, and a small handful of researchers have really delved into them. But we're really trying to bring this out into the light now and say, none of these calls make what they're actually reporting these calls. Put aside the technology question, how are the calls were made? What is reported in the calls makes no sense, does not add up whatsoever with the official story. You also have to switch to flight 11. You've got a totally crazy, unrealistic situation described on the plane, where supposedly there has been two stabbings of flight attendants and a person stabbed in the neck and who's bleeding out and basically dying. And there's been mace released on the plane. All the passengers in first class and business class have come back to coach because there's mace in the front of the plane. And yet supposedly, according to flight attendant Betty Ong, none of the passengers and coach know that there is a hijacking going on in the plane. They're supposedly under the impression that there's just a medical emergency. Well, if all of these passengers in first class and coach actually saw this violence happen and they saw the cockpit be invaded, they would start telling the people around them, right? So how is that? And to one last piece of it to tell you is, you know, then they talk, the Betty Ong talks about her flight attendant colleagues trying to get into the cockpit. And there's the idea that you get is that there's nobody in first class or business class, no hijackers trying to stop them. So essentially, where are the pilots and where are the hijackers? Are they all just locked in the cockpit together? You've got five hijackers and two pilots in the cockpit together. It becomes cartoonish, right? So nothing adds up when you really start to delve into what is being reported in these phone calls. And I think the kicker for a lot of people is that the majority of the people who made these phone calls were reported by their loved ones or by the people that spoke to them from the ground have been extremely calm when they were on the phone. Like they were not actually involved in an emergency situation. You know, just extraordinarily, some of the terms used, shockingly calm, extraordinarily calm, you know, and to the point where some of the people that received the calls didn't believe that the person was actually in a real hijacking, at least initially. So...
It's unbelievable, that part of the story. Then, of course, we have, which we're going to dive more deeply into here in just a short while, with a special report that we have on the remote controlling of the aircraft. So if you understand that sort of narrative that's being pushed out here, then you understand how the evidence seems to support that these aircraft were remotely controlled. Because as you point out, you're having a struggle, you're fighting with people, and you're also descending at 10,000 feet per second or per minute, and doing a controlled turn into a tower with very little flight experience at all. Like you're literally, these guys are like the worst pilots in the world. They have zero to almost negative flight experience. They're so bad. And they're pulling off maneuvers that not even Maverick could pull off in Top Gun, right? So that part of the story just is laughable once you start diving into it, right?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I think both pieces of this, that they could have hijacked the planes, you know, and then somehow even just figured out where to turn, you know, like as soon as they get control of the plane, how are they like to turn the plane and to like get your bearings and to do that in a situation where you've probably covered in blood. You've got like, you know, 200 right. pounds like, covered in blood that you've just pulled out of the cockpit. Like it's just that aspect of it, the stress aspect of it is also very implausible, but yeah, they wouldn't have been able to get the planes all the way there. And then the final maneuvers to actually hit the targets, hitting the towers and hitting the Pentagon are just, you know, it's fairy tale stuff that even inexperienced pilots or really any pilots could maneuver the planes in that way.
Well, I want to thank you, Ted, for everything that you've been doing, your organization, organizing this symposium, bringing all these incredible speakers together. And for our show, I really want to thank you because we're kicking off our week-long look at 9/11, multiple stories. But we thought we'd have you on first to kind of kick everything off here because this is going to be a big week, hopefully shattering a lot of lies, a lot of propaganda during this week-long event here on Redacted. So we thank you so much, Ted, for all of your work.
Thank you, Clayton. Thanks for all your work.
And thanks to all of you for being a part of our show here. So as I just mentioned with Ted, we are going to now, I want all of you to stay tuned because we're about to launch a premiere of my interview with Captain Dan Hanley. And Captain Dan Hanley is going to dive more deeply into veteran pilot on exactly how he believed these aircraft were remotely controlled and how he, even as an experienced pilot, says that these maneuvers are impossible for many of the pilots that he's spoken to. So I want all of you now to stick around because we're about to launch this premiere. And what will happen if you're watching us here on YouTube is that when this live stream ends in just a few seconds here, that you will be redirected to the live premiere of our interview with Captain Dan Hanley, specifically on the hijackings and the aircraft and how they were arguably remote controlled that day. So stick around. Please watch this next interview here. Thank you guys so much for continuing to subscribe to us and being a part of our great community. Now watch this interview and this premiere for our week-long special on 9/11.